for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
I hope everyone tuning in to listen to this podcast is healthy, happy, and safe. It gives me great pleasure to announce the guest speaker for this event, whose hippocampus I might pick in just a few moments. Dr. Stephen Giannata, Professor and Chairman of Neurological Surgery, joined the Department of Neurosurgery at USC in 1980 and became the chairman in 2004. He is also the program director of the Neurosurgery Residency Training Program and earned his medical degree from the University of Michigan, where he also did his neurosurgical training. He is involved in many local, national, and international committees and organizations. He has special interests and expertise in two broad areas of neurological surgery. Dr. Giannata has gained recognition for his work in cerebrovascular disease of the brain and has surgically treated over 2,000 intracranial aneurysms. Doctor has also has an interest and special expertise in surgical approaches to the cranial base and has removed more than 800 acoustic neuromas. His current laboratory work, in conjunction with Florence Hoffman, PhD, involves the study of basic cellular and epigenetic mechanisms of human cerebral arteriovenous malformations. Thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us here today, Doctor. Thank you so, so much.
You're welcome, Tanishka. Thanks for asking me.
So let's dive into the questions, and I'm sure the first one is something that many people should be wary of, and that would be, since the target audience of this podcast generally includes the general public and medical students, if you could shed light on the symptoms and cause of a brain aneurysm, that would be really great.
Say again, the cause of a brain aneurysm, is that what you're asking?
The symptoms and cause, yes.
Symptoms, okay. Well, a brain aneurysm, first of all, is a weak spot on a blood vessel of the brain, and over time that weak spot balloons out, and the part of the blood vessel that is ballooned obviously is weakened and thinned, and the possibility exists that that aneurysm could burst, allowing blood at arterial pressure to be injected into the brain cavity, thereby causing several things. One is a terrible increase in the pressure inside the head, which squashes the brain, which causes, potentially can cause unconsciousness. And two, it could actually damage the brain by that spurt of blood. That's known as a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And the symptoms of that are an intense headache that's nothing like any headache that a person has ever had before, in association with neck stiffness and visual problems, such as light bothering the eyes. It can also cause neurological deficits and coma. When aneurysms are present but don't bleed, there's almost never any symptoms. That is, unless the aneurysm itself starts to enlarge and presses on something. For instance, an aneurysm of the internal carotid artery, just as it enters the skull from the neck, comes very close to the optic nerve. Mm-hmm. And an aneurysm that starts to grow and press on the optic nerve can cause visual dimming in one eye. And that could be a symptom of an aneurysm, even though the aneurysm hasn't ruptured.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Doctor. So I had the privilege of shadowing a neurosurgeon when I was in Mumbai, India. And I noticed that he gave an atropine injection during a balloon angioplasty. So why exactly is this done for the general public?
Well, atropine is a medication that blocks certain impulses. There's a couple of reasons to give atropine. One is atropine will slow down the peristalsis of the stomach and gut. And if you're going to be under any kind of anesthetic or you're going to be sedated, atropine will keep the patient from vomiting during a procedure. Number two, if you're going to do something that's going to slow down the heart rate by some sort of reflex action that stimulates either the vagus nerve or the trigeminal nerve in the brain, that might slow down the heart, causing low blood pressure. And in that circumstance, atropine can also reinvigorate the heart and bring the heart rate back up, so you're working with a normal blood pressure.
Amazing. Thank you. That was very insightful, doctor. So this is a really controversial question. And, many people have debated this, but where is the physiological location of consciousness in the brain? have they managed to pinpoint that?
No. Well, first of all, it's not a pinpoint. So that's what's causing all of the controversy. The brain consciousness is due to a reverberation of a whole lot of brain circuitry, a whole lot. So trying to find one place that's the seat of consciousness is going to be a very frustrating endeavor. So it's much more complicated than that. And most neurosurgeons don't get involved in the studying of the physiology of consciousness unless they've done so in their pre-medical studies as undergrads, where they get interested in various aspects of behavior, psychology, and then maybe neurophysiology, and they start looking at those kinds of deeper problems. Once you're focused in a neurosurgical career, your interest in research takes a different directions, because now you're interested in getting at the underpinnings of the disease disorders that you treat as a surgeon. Mm-hmm. So we rarely, with certain exceptions, rarely are called upon to do something directly to the brain that's going to affect cognition. Mm-hmm. One example of that is when the patient develops hydrocephalus, which is overproduction of the spinal fluid in the ventricles of the brain, can cause decreased cognition. A surgeon can help that situation by putting in a tube inside the ventricles of the brain, draining the spinal fluid out gradually down the tube, which is then placed in the abdominal cavity. The spinal fluid goes into the abdominal cavity, is ultimately absorbed, the pressure equalizes inside the head, and in many circumstances, the patient's cognition will improve. That's one of the rare instances where neurosurgeons can directly treat something that's causing a major impact in cognition. Another would be if there were, for instance, a large brain tumor that is compressing, let's say, the frontal lobes, where we know most of cognition and executive function exists. In that circumstance, we can also cause dramatic improvements in executive function and cognition by removing the tumor. But as far as studying the basis of cognition, most neurosurgeons don't get involved in that kind of work. Those are more physiologists and behavioral psychologists that get involved in that kind of work.
Okay. So on a similar note, there's the binding problem in neuroscience, which concerns how items that are encoded by distinct brain circuits can be combined for perception, decision, and action. Well, what would your take on it be? Because I think it's wrong to specify and localize function of a brain to different parts of it. What would your take on it be?
Well, again, that's not something that neurosurgeons get involved with studying, but obviously binding of stimuli is what the brain does. A brain is a miraculous organ that we're going to take many, 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 many more decades to understand how it functions. But How can single impulses that, let's say, transmit color information, for instance, how does the brain then deal with those kinds of stimuli, combine them with other stimuli to produce a fully formed image and all of the thoughts and memories that go around that image? So that's what they mean by the binding problem. Mm-hmm. It's not really a problem. The problem is understanding all of the circuitry and how the circuits interact with each other to produce such a wonderful image. So it's almost binding is a given. The problem is we don't understand how and why the brain does it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll figure that out much later in the future. But for now, that was really good justification. Thank you so much for that. So can you explain what the physiology of the hip, can you explain the physiology of the hippocampus and what happens when epilepsy and seizures cause lesions on it? Because I remember reading about Henry Molaison, and I think he had retrograde amnesia. So could you just enlighten the general public about it?
Well, the hippocampus is necessary for memory. It's in the medial portion of the temporal lobe. The temporal lobe is a part of the brain that is probably of all the parts of the brain, the most susceptible to epileptic impulses. And we know that things can happen to a fetus before it's born and during birth that might injure that part of the temporal lobe. And as the child ages, they develop epilepsy. It's part of the treatment for epilepsy is to remove the part of the brain that's firing off those abnormal impulses that cause the epileptic seizures and ultimately, in many circumstances, cause unconsciousness. A surgeon can pinpoint by doing physiologic studies using electrodes that go on the head and sometimes actually in the brain, can pinpoint a small part of the brain that could be giving off those abnormal impulses. If that part of the brain is not close to something that's really important, then we can go in surgically and remove that part of the brain. In the medial temporal lobe, the hippocampus is there. And if the hippocampus is very close to the epileptic focus, we need to know that. And if the epileptic focus is on the side opposite of the temporal lobe that has memory and speech, then it's much safer to remove that part of the brain. And so we actually test people by giving them a medication that quiets one side of the brain to determine whether that side is contains speech and memory, that part of the hippocampus. And if it does, then we know we can't remove that part of the brain. If on the other hand, we give a medication that quiets, let's say for the sake of argument, the right hippocampus, and the patient is drowsy, but can still talk and can still have memories, then we know that we can remove the right temporal lobe or part of it and perhaps cure the patient's seizures. So that's the relationship between the hippocampus and epilepsy.
Thank you. So doctor, what would you say is the most important neurological sign indicating major intracranial pathology?
Well, there are a lot of important signs and it depends on what the pathology is, but the most common sign of intracranial pathology, of course, is headache. The problem with that is everybody has headaches and hardly anybody has intracranial pathology as a result or as a cause of their headaches. So that's where diagnostic abilities and training in neurodiagnosis, which occurs both in neurosurgery training and neurology training, comes in. When a patient comes in to a doctor's office complaining of headaches, and that person isn't really trained in neurology or neurosurgery, there's always a question, does this person really have something wrong inside their head? Or can I just give them some pain medicine and send them on their merry way? And that and some of that diagnostic ability comes with knowing the various types of headache, being able to, for instance, separate out the headache that someone gets from, let's say, migraine, and the headache that someone gets from having an arteriovenous malformation of the brain. Those headaches can be very similar. And it takes a very experienced neurologist or neurosurgeon to try to help the patient decipher what kind of headache they have. And so that's where our imaging studies that have gotten so sophisticated over the last 20 or 30 years come in handy, because our MRI scanner can in great detail show the normal brain and show any abnormalities within the brain. And so people that have headaches that are unusual, or they're a change in their normal headache pattern that they've always had since they were a kid, or they are getting progressively worse, or they are beginning to become associated with other neurologic problems, like, for instance, visual problems or memory loss, that's when we resort to MRI imaging of the brain to be able to especially diagnose things like brain tumors.
Of course, definitely. And that's exactly why I started this podcast, because there's knowledge that only some seasoned surgeons would know, and you can't get off the internet, you know, especially when it comes to diagnosis. It's only something that, you know, seasoned surgeons could, you know. That's why I wanted to interview, and it's so nice speaking to you. So doctor, I have two more questions to go. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but could you please explain Huntington's disease and what causes it?
Yeah, nobody knows what causes Huntington's disease, although it does have a hereditary, it does have hereditary underpinnings. It's a terrible degenerative disease of the brain. There are a fair number of degenerative diseases of the brain, like Parkinson's and things like degenerative diseases of the spinal cord, like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And it's very difficult to understand the exact nature of those kinds of diseases. But in Huntington's, there's a group of cells that are involved in memory and consciousness that spontaneously begin to deteriorate, usually in early adulthood. And by mid-adulthood, the patients are devastated from the standpoint of memory and functionality, and they usually die in mid-age. Again, it's has some hereditary underpinnings. What the exact nature of the degeneration of those neurons is operant there. Obviously, they're working on that vigorously, and I don't know the latest research on Huntington's disease. Again, Huntington's disease, unlike Parkinson's disease, is not a disease that neurosurgeons treat, and neurosurgeons really have no role in the diagnosis or management of Huntington's disease. Unlike Parkinson's disease, which is also a degenerative disease of the deeper regions of the brain, that surgeons can help. One of the major disabilities that comes from Parkinson's disease is tremor. And as you know, Parkinson's disease is in older individuals, mostly men. Their hand starts to shake so badly that they can't tie their shoes. They can't drink a cup of coffee without spilling it. They can't do their job anymore. They can't play sports anymore. So there's this major disability, and neurosurgeons have developed a technique where we can stimulate a deep part of the brain to mitigate that tremor. It's called deep brain stimulation. And there are several targets in the deep part of the brain where we can put a stimulator in that target put a generator under the patient's skin, and that generator will continually stimulate that part of the brain. The tremor goes away completely, and the person with that devastating tremor is now easily rehabilitated back to normal function. So it's almost miraculous in how deep brain stimulation works for Parkinson's disease. Unfortunately, there's nothing like that for Huntington's disease.
Thank you, doctor. That was really insightful. I had no idea that you could use a generator. That's something new for me as well. So my last question to you, my second last question to you, I'm sorry. What are the different types of traumatic brain injury, and in what ways can they each impact the brain and behavior?
Well, a traumatic brain injury is a matter of degree. And it starts obviously with mild concussion. And a mild concussion could just be a brief sense of surprise, where you bump your head into something that you weren't anticipating, and you have a psychological sense of being, quote, stunned, unquote, or surprised or shocked, and maybe nothing else, all the way to the point where a concussive injury can cause a temporary loss of consciousness. It used to be that you didn't diagnose concussion unless you could get a history from the patient that they actually were unconscious for a second or two. We know that that's not correct anymore, that even something as simple as a soccer player heading a soccer ball can actually, in some circumstances, especially if the person has some susceptibility, can actually cause minor damage to the brain. And in those particular types of people that have that susceptibility, multiple headings of the soccer ball can over time cause some element of cognitive disability. Usually, though, soccer players aren't disabled unless, like hockey players or boxers, they have multiple concussive injuries over time. And so in those circumstances, we know that there are traumatic changes that go on in the cells of the brain that actually can progress over time to dementia and, more importantly, psychiatric abnormalities like depression. And we know that some of our professional football players, for instance, have actually committed suicide due to the psychological impact of multiple concussions.
That's very true. I've seen the movie Concussion, which talks about the way these football players are affected, especially by traumatic brain injury. And that was very insightful. Thank you so much, doctor. And my last question to you is, what research are you working on as of now? And what has been your most interesting case as a surgeon?
Well, Tanishka, first of all, I do interesting cases every day.
I can imagine.
There certainly is not one case that I consider the most interesting. The interesting thing about the cases are the patients and how well they do. If it's something that's an extremely difficult case, like an arteriovenous malformation of the brain or a large aneurysm that threatens them not only during their day-to-day activities, but threatens them during the surgery, because the surgery itself can actually cause severe brain damage. And so it's particularly gratifying when you have a, let's say for the sake of argument, a young 25-year-old woman who's a grad student, and she develops a hemorrhage in her brain from an arteriovenous malformation. And we as vascular neurosurgeons remove that malformation, don't cause any brain damage, and that 25-year-old goes on, finishes her grad studies, and gets married. That is what's known as a great case. Mm-hmm. Not so much because it's something that you've never seen before, or it's unique or bizarre, but it's the whole picture and the whole process of doing a complex challenging surgery in a patient that does extremely well. And you get to follow that patient after their surgery's over and watch their progress and see the success, their success, which translates into your success as a surgeon. That's what makes a case a great case.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. It must be so gratifying. And kudos to you as a surgeon and going into medicine. You must be doing great work. I would love to talk more to you like later. But that's enough for today. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you so, so much for being a part of this podcast, Doctor. I understand it must be really busy, especially during times like these. But thank you so, so much.
You're welcome, Tanisha, and good luck with your project.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.